The History of Literature podcast is a member of the Podglomerate Network and Lit Hub Radio. Hello, I'm Jack Wilson. Welcome to the History of Literature. Okay, here we go. A great episode today. Dad poetry. Remember our episode on bad poetry? Well, this is dad poetry. It does have one flaw, only one, I assure you, or at least one flaw, I assure you. How's that for an assurance? Anyway, we have some audio issues, unfortunately. We have a guest caller, our old friend, Professor Bill, and the audio is not the best. I think we need to get Professor Bill a new mic. Anyway, the quality comes and goes, so please bear with it. There are a few rough patches, but they get better. We did our best to fix it up. All for you, dear listener. So, it's Father's Day here on Sunday, and it made me reflect on fathers and fathering. And I invited our poetry expert, Professor Bill, to join us for a discussion of how these themes are reflected in poetry. He chose a couple of stunning poems for us to talk about. Seamus Heaney, one of my favorite poets, and on the Mount Rushmore, my personal Mount Rushmore for translators, is Beowulf is a thing of beauty. Seamus Heaney's poem, Digging, is a wonderful little poem about inheriting something from your father and your grandfather and trying to steel oneself to live up to that inheritance. And Robert Hayden, in another beautiful poem. We'll have both of those coming up, along with Professor Bill's take on them. And I wanted to give you something else, something about dads. I have my own piece to share, my humble contribution. It's inspired by my dad, the Wisconsin Buddha. I'll do that after the discussion with Professor Bill. Remember, you can find us on Facebook and our website, and you can email me at jackwilsonauthor@gmail.com. That's J-A-C-K-E, wilsonauthor@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you. Let me know how you're doing. Any requests, we take them all the time. So, here we go with Professor Bill recommending and discussing some favorite poems about fathers. Hello, everyone. This is Jack here to tell you about a way to eat better and easier. That's right, Factor, and their delicious, ready-to-eat meals. These things are amazing, chef-crafted, always fresh, never frozen. All you do is heat them up and you're ready to go. No prepping, cooking, or cleanup, and you get something healthy, nutritious, and tasty. I love Factor meals, especially on those days when I'm in the office. They're better for me than snacks or junk food, and much cheaper and faster than buying my lunch at a restaurant. You can choose options like Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, Keto, and you can change your schedule to get as much or as little as you need every week, whatever suits you and your family best. Head to factormeals.com/literature50 and use code literature50 to get 50% off. That's code literature50 at factormeals.com/literature50 to get 50% off. Hey, grown-ups, the Cat in the Hat cast is a new podcast from Wondery, perfect for the whole family. Join the Cat in the Hat and your favorite Dr. Seuss characters as they get whisked away on a new adventure every week. Fish dreams of creating his very own polite and quiet podcast. That is, until he gets a surprise visit to his Fishbowl podcast studio from the Cat in the Hat himself, and it becomes very clear that the cat has other plans for the podcast, and those plans are the opposite of quiet. The cat may be disruptive, but it turns out he's also a great help to get Fish out of all kinds of predicaments. Bursting with music, silliness, and rhymes, the Cat in the Hat cast encourages us all to find fun that is funny in every episode. Sing along to new favorite songs, try your luck at Titanic tongue twisters, have some fun with wondrous wordplay, and most importantly, bring your family along for all of the adventures in the Cat in the Hat cast. Follow the Cat in the Hat cast on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to the Cat in the Hat cast ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts. Okay, joining me now for a special look at poetry about fathers and fatherhood is Professor Bill Hogan of Providence College. Professor Bill, welcome back to the History of Literature.
How are you, Jack?
Good. So I asked you to select a few poems. We've got Father's Day coming up around the corner, and I really didn't give you much more guidance than that. And I was struck by when you sent me your list. I wanted to start by mentioning a couple of famous poems about fathers that you didn't choose. Like My Papa's Waltz by Theodore Rethke and Daddy by Sylvia Plath. And it kind of made me think that you were choosing to celebrate or to understand fatherhood as a sort of decent and well-intentioned institution, as opposed to those poems that dig into abusive fathers or real complaints about fathers.
Right. Well, the two that we chose, Those Winter Sundays by Robert Hayden and Digging by Seamus Heaney, they're both really, really well-known poems. But what I love about them, I think, is that they both have speakers who recognize that they are very different from their fathers and maybe feel even a little guilty about that, that they're so different from their fathers, but nevertheless have this real respect for their fathers too. So they're able to look past the differences that they realize exist and appreciate what their fathers were able to do.
Right. And I found them, I saw that in both of them, but I also noticed some kind of key differences in the way that they discussed it. So let's get to that. Let's start with Seamus Heaney. I thought that was an interesting one. What drew you to Digging?
In this poem, there's a speaker who is a writer, I think, and the father is a farmer. And the difference between those two characters, the speaker, I think, is an intellectual and feels that from his father's point of view, he might seem like an idler or seem lazy or somehow seem like he's not living up to the difficult, hardscrabble life of the farmer.
Right. I know that Heaney, he's not talking about immigrants, but I've heard this often said about immigrants in the context of America, and they would say the pattern is, you know, the grandfather comes in there, maybe working in the factory, then the next generation goes to college, and then the third generation writes novels. And this kind of has that, right? The grandfather dug peat, and the father is digging lines in the soil for potatoes, and then Heaney is the third generation, he becomes a poet.
Right, and he goes to college, and he's the whole poem, the situation of the poem is the speaker is looking out of his window, it seems. He's sitting at his desk writing, and he's looking out of his window, and there's his father. Well, whether this literally happens actually in the poem, he's looking back over years and picturing his father out in the flower beds. But yeah, there's definitely that, the sense of a generation passing and the speaker of the poem not doing what his father or grandfather had done.
Right. Okay, well, let me play this for the listeners so they can refamiliarize themselves with the poem Digging by Seamus Heaney.
Between my finger and my thumb, the squat pen rests, snug as a gun. Under my window, a clean rasping sound, when the spade sinks into gravelly ground. My father, digging. I look down till his straining rump among the flower beds bends low, comes up 20 years away, stooping in rhythm through potato drills where he was digging. The coarse boot nestled on the lug. The shaft against the inside knee was levered firmly. He rooted out tall tops, buried the bright edge deep to scatter new potatoes that we picked, loving their cool hardness in our hands. My God, the old man could handle a spade, just like his old man. My grandfather cut more turf in a day than any other man on Toner's Bog. Once I carried him milk in a bottle, corked sloppily with paper. He straightened up to drink it, then fell to right away, nicking and slicing neatly, heaving sods over his shoulder, going down and down for the good turf, digging. The cold smell of potato mould, the squelch and slap of soggy peat, the curt cuts of an edge through living roots awaken in my head. But I've no spade to follow men like them. Between my finger and my thumb, the squat pen rests. I'll dig with it.
Okay, so I noticed much of that is kind of a straight narrative description, where the father and the grandfather are these hardworking, salt-of-the-earth types. But there are some really vivid lines in there, like the pen being snug as a gun.
Right.
In his hand.
Well, the poem was written in 1966, or it was published in his first book, Death of a Naturalist, in 1966, which in Northern Ireland was just at the time that the Troubles are reigniting. These are things that real men do. They fight and they work. And here's our speaker actually working with the pen. And though at the end of the poem, he argues that that's just as valid, just as worthwhile. He says, between my finger and my thumb, the squat pen rests, I'll dig with it. It seems to end with this affirmation that that's a valid choice. But I think throughout the poem, there's this almost anxiety that he's not doing enough. He's not being a real man.
Yeah. I had a sort of a different interpretation. Tell me if you think this is right. For the snug as a gun, I think of, like, if you've ever held a gun, it's got this heaviness and it has this power. It's kind of it's designed to shape the hand to be, to fit the hand perfectly. And when you hold it, it almost feels like its purpose comes through into your hand. Like its purpose is to be fired and to have this power. And
right.
I took it as Heaney was kind of saying, this is how a pen feels to me. When I hold it, I feel like I know what I'm supposed to do and I know what I've been put here on this earth to do. He doesn't say this, but one can imagine he probably doesn't feel that way when he holds a spade.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, the power and the violence of it too. That something in his writing is it's a life or death kind of enterprise. This is not just some frivolous college hobby or something like that.
Right. I also did pick up on what you were saying before about the anxiety. Do you think Heaney's father would have understood and appreciated this poem?
I think so. I mean, I don't actually know the story there, whether...
I don't either. I don't know anything about his father. I just sort of mean, if you were a father who was kind of a salt of the earth type and your son was a poet, do you think this would reconcile you to the life of a poet?
Well, what really strikes me is the care and the love with which he depicts his father and the image of him digging in the dirt.
Mm-hmm.
It's so clear that there's a respect and a love there when he describes the father with the spade. The coarse boot nestled on the lug, the shaft against the inside knee was levered firmly.
Mm.
You know, the attention that he's paid, obviously, to the work that the father's doing to support the family, I think that respect would come through and the father would have to appreciate that.
Mm-hmm. And just the almost like a cry of, by God, the old man could handle a spade.
Right.
Just like his old man. I mean, he really does. It's like it's urgent for him. There's an urgency for us to be aware of that he's not dismissing his father as less educated or less important or somehow less refined because he's not a poet, but that there is a beauty in the skill and the hard work that his father had.
Right. I mean, there's almost a genius to the handling of the spade.
Yeah. Now, on the other hand, I kind of did feel like this was the poem of a 20-something person and a poet who I mean, he does give poetry kind of a pride of place. You know, there's a suggestion here that the pen is worthwhile, and that's how he's going to devote his life, which is great for those of us who love poetry and who believe in it. But I did kind of wonder if it would cut kind of the other way for people who maybe don't think poetry. Yeah, people who are skeptical, they might say, well, you know what? That's great if you want to write some words down on a page, but there's a lot of hard work that has to be done, and maybe we should admire the people who just get to work and do it without complaining.
That's interesting. I mean, you think so? At the end of the poem, it's so much at the very end of the poem that he finally affirms,
mm-hmm.
I'll dig with it.
Mm-hmm.
It. To me, the strongest thing that comes through is this sense of inadequacy.
Like,
so I guess I don't read this poem as an uncomplicated or a full-throated affirmation of the worth of poetry. It's more because I'm not able to do the kind of work that my father and my grandfather did, I found this other path that will work for me and that will be a substitute. I'm not sure it'll be even an equal substitute.
Right.
That line in the second to last stanza, but I've no spade to follow men like them. I always read that with, again, that sense of anxiety and a sense of inadequacy somehow.
Yeah, and he does seem to be saying, I have a lot, poetry has a lot to live up to here. Poetry needs to be at least as useful and at least as honorable as the predecessors that I've had. I'll dig with it because I need to dig in. I need to make something worthwhile out of the poetry. It's not something I can just take lightly because that's not why my father and grandfather worked as hard as they did.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and finally, so this poem is a love letter to his father and his grandfather, I think. And that's why I think there's no way that the father could fail to read this, I think, as in a positive light.
I just wondered if it was the 20-something would write a poem like this. And let's say if the poet had been in his 50s or 60s, we might have seen someone looking back and saying, yeah, I wrote all this poetry, I won some prizes, but you know what? I'm not sure that any of it was as worthwhile as the potatoes that my father was able to grow with his hard work.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, I do know that Heaney read this poem up till the end of his life, you know, at public readings. It was something that he often pulled out.
Yeah.
So it's not something he wanted to relegate to the dustbin of history.
Right. So this, I mean, we can move on a little bit here. It's one of the things that interests me most about thinking about fatherhood is that there are people who love poetry or people who are poets, and they're trying to make their fathers understand what their love is like. And you're a professor of poetry, which is, I mean, being a professor is a real profession and everyone knows that you get paid for it and everything. But how was it when you rolled out your career to your parents? Did they, was there any concern that they had that a life of poetry wasn't going to be serious enough or lucrative enough?
That's an interesting question. They didn't really comment that I was, you know, throwing things away or that, but it's definitely the case that I'm different from my parents, and I don't think they really understand the attachment to poetry that I have. So,
right.
When we were planning this session and you were talking about our own fathers and, you know,
yeah,
the kind of poems that they like, I'm not sure that my dad could even name a poem. A favorite poem, I should say.
Right.
He's very much a concrete kind of thinker.
Have you ever been tempted to buy him a poem, you know, or give him a poem, you know, for Father's Day or his birthday? Or did you ever try anything like that or think, if I just subscribe to this poetry journal, maybe maybe it'll open some doors for him?
I didn't. I must say I didn't. Did you?
No.
You talked about your literary life and ambitions with your parents.
Yeah. No, see, that's the thing. I want to tell people who are out there who might be, you know, 18 or 19 and thinking about that, it probably won't work. It's probably,
right.
You know, just if you have a parent who loves poetry, that's great. Then you can't go wrong. You just find something that's to their taste. But if they're not somebody who loves poetry, I'm not sure that chances are that kind of an effort might just backfire.
Yeah. And I mean, that's the way it always seemed to me.
Yeah.
Although I will say that it has resulted in kind of the relationship I have with my parents just kind of leaves out a lot of my work and a lot of my scholarly work. We have interesting conversations about teaching and how teaching is a worthwhile enterprise and so on, but more specific literary interests and scholarly interests, that it's just not something that we talk about too much.
Yeah, which is okay.
Yeah, and it's fine, sure.
So my father, I could think of two poems that clicked with him. The first one I've got memorized, so I'm going to recite it in its entirety. Little Willie. Do you know this poem?
I don't, actually.
Yeah. Okay. It goes, Little Willie took a chance, caught the ball, but lost his pants. He's out, cried the team with a cheer, and so was Little Willie's rear.
Great.
That was the first one. The second one was one that's longer, and I asked you to take a look at it before we started the episode.
It's quite something.
Yeah, it was a poem that my father liked so well. And again, this is somebody, you know, Little Willie was the only poem I had ever known him to know. He liked this poem so well that he got like a printed copy of it with an illustration, and he framed it and he hung it in our bathroom.
Yep. Interesting.
And this is, and I mean, don't get me wrong, my dad is a great guy and he's an exemplary father, and the poetry bug just isn't something he ever caught.
But I like the idea of posting this over the John.
It's not bad, right? So the poem we're talking about is The Passing of the Backhouse by James Whitcomb Riley. And what did you think of the poem?
I mean, it's interesting. It's got this nostalgia for...
Yes.
Kind of rural life and the simplicity of it, and it's also got low humor in it, you know, it's definitely meant to be funny.
Yep.
But ultimately I feel like it's kind of affirmative of a simple rural American life.
Yep. And James Whitcomb Riley was called the Hoosier poet, and he was also called the children's poet. And I think this is probably what my dad and probably a lot of people just consider to be a great poem. It's comic. You don't have to think too hard. It doesn't put that kind of demand on you. There's not, you know, linguistic challenges or imagery that you need to unpack or anything. It rhymes, and it has some old-timey language.
Its meter is very regular. Yeah.
Very regular meter. And it's really about nostalgia. And it's kind of this, if we haven't made it clear, it's basically this long description of a guy saying, you know, here's what the outhouse was like. I kind of miss those old days. There was a lot of funny things that happened with the outhouse, and just sort of a description. It's kind of lukewarm bath, Norman Rockwell-y kind of a poem.
Well, I mean, and what's interesting, it's clear to me that poetry had a much more prominent place in popular entertainment around the turn of the 20th century. Riley was a big name and was a best-selling poet and very popular. And lots of people probably did what your dad did and put this poem up in the bathroom at the house.
Yeah.
And I was trying to think as I was reading the poem, you know, what do we have poets today that are sort of the equivalent of James Whitcomb Riley? Shel Silverstein was about the closest I could come up with, or Billy Collins maybe, although I think he's more literary and maybe more serious and certainly less popular than James Whitcomb Riley would have been.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe you don't need it. Maybe it would be, you could maybe look at some type of simple stand-up comic or a basic television show would maybe serve that kind of a purpose now.
Right.
You know, what's interesting, though, is my grandfather actually had long stretches of Chaucer memorized.
Oh, yeah. I think that was a fairly standard pedagogical technique.
Yeah. So he had, you know, if you asked him, like, if he knew a poem, he'd launch into Chaucer.
Yep.
And it was another example of the kind of thing where my grandfather, who was Depression era, just did not really understand my father. And I would get glimpses of that. Like, my dad didn't know how to tie a tie. You know, he never learned how to tie a tie. And I had to pass like a Cub Scout, or I had to get a Cub Scout badge. And one of the things I had to do was tie a tie and get, you know, some adult to sign off that I knew how to tie a tie. And my father only has clip-on ties.
Yeah.
You know, no real
That's
ties.
That's amazing. So, to this day.
To this day. So he drove me to my grandfather's house. And it was like, oh, what are you guys doing here? It was like, well, you know.
I needed to certify.
Needs to learn how to tie a tie. And my grandfather just looked at my dad just in disbelief. You know, like how can you be a grown man? You know, like how did this happen? Yeah, and it's because my dad was kind of the 50s, and it was, you know, sock hops and soda fountains, and that was kind of his world. And he didn't go through the Depression. He wasn't out there smoking meat in the backyard and catching fish and all the stuff that my canning vegetables and all the stuff my grandfather did. But he also just didn't have that same practicality that my grandfather had.
So this poem, I mean, as a favorite of your dad, this poem would not have reflected anything that in his life. He didn't have an outhouse.
No.
As a kid.
No.
Okay.
It would really be, but you know what my dad really likes to this day is like old time radio.
Yeah.
And so he would have liked, his heroes probably would have been comedians who would have been making jokes a lot like the ones James Whitcomb Riley makes.
Right.
You know, Jack Benny and guys like that. So he kind of reached back into those turn of the century vaudeville type guys.
Right. And I mean, you know, what itch is poetry scratching for that kind of reader?
Yep.
Versus, you know, another kind of maybe more literary reader. But, you know, again, it must be said that poetry is, as a kind of cultural force, is so much weaker now than it would have been at the turn of the 20th century.
Yeah, right.
And, well, you know, it's easy to kind of look down our noses at more popular poetry, but it obviously served some kind of function and brought a lot of pleasure to a lot of people.
I think maybe the replacement for that kind of poetry, maybe it's blogs and Twitter, I guess, Facebook.
Maybe, yeah, kind of communally. But I mean, the thing about poetry is it's communally known.
Yeah.
It's not something necessarily that, I mean, I think of blogs and Twitter and social media in general as a place where we express ourselves very
right.
offhandedly, you know, not a lot of forethought necessarily.
That's
and
true.
And here, this is a text that he would have shared with somebody else. It's almost like a piece of folk wisdom or something.
Okay, well, let's get back to to the poetry you picked, and let's take a look at the next one, which is Robert Hayden.
Well, this is an extremely popular poem.
Yeah.
And is, you know, much anthologized and taught in a lot of sort of freshman English type courses, but it's just an absolute gem of craftsmanship and is very compact. It's just three short stanzas long, but so vividly depicts this speaker's feeling for his father. And again, the dynamic, I think, is that the speaker is remembering back to some of the sacrifices that the father made throughout his childhood that maybe at the time he didn't appreciate, the son did not appreciate. And now, looking back, is feeling that he didn't appreciate that. And again, I think there's a little bit of that guilt. I mean, it's obvious that the speaker of this poem is also a kind of educated, kind of literary kind of person in a way that the father was not. And so there's a similar dynamic as we found in the Heaney poem.
Okay, well, let me play it for the listeners.
Here is a poem that comes directly out of my boyhood in Detroit. It's called Those Winter Sundays. Sundays, too, my father got up early and put his clothes on in the blue-black cold. Then, with cracked hands that ached from labor in the weekday weather, made bank fires blaze. No one ever thanked him. I'd wake and hear the coal splintering, breaking. When the rooms were warm, he'd call, and slowly I would rise and dress, fearing the chronic angers of that house, speaking indifferently to him who had driven out the coal, and polish my good shoes as well. What did I know? What did I know of love's austere and lonely offices?
Okay, there's just some beautiful lines in there, and the ending is completely haunting.
Oh, that's great.
But I also like the way it begins. I mean, just Sundays 2, just those two words. There's so much in those words that there's no rest, no day of rest, no leisure. It's this unrelenting life with work, and then, you know, Sundays too. Like, even on Sundays, it's very subtle, but it really conveys a lot in just those two words about what kind of life the father was living.
Absolutely. You know, that it goes without saying that every other day, all the other 6 days of the week, he also got up early.
Yeah.
And also that, you know, that first line, Sundays too, my father got up early, establishes that this is a speaker in the here and now thinking back. So already there's this sense of reminiscence of something lost.
Mm-hmm.
That duality of time where the speaker is now and the memories that the poem is engaging were then.
Right. It almost sets up this drama or this, we almost get a double narrative right from the beginning of the one thing we're going to find out what the father did and why he got up early. But on the other hand, we're also going to find out what the speaker thought about this or why this is coming to mind now and what's
and how
behind
he's feeling
the,
now. Exactly.
Yeah, what's behind the reflection.
The other cool thing about the structure of the poem, that first stanza where we're really describing the father, kind of like a Heaney poem, the physical description of the father doing work.
Right.
Here he got up early and put his clothes on in the blue-black cold, then with cracked hands that ached from labor in the weekday weather. There's a lot of hard consonant sounds there, the C's. Blue-black cold, then with cracked hands that ached. And the rhythm is a little bit jagged, too.
Yeah.
I think of this as the father's stanza. Again, he's creaking, getting up out of bed. It's cold.
Yep.
He's got to go down he's got to go down and set the fire going. And it comes through in the sound of that stanza, too. We can talk in a second when we get to the second stanza that whole rhythm and the whole sound of the language changes because I think we start to talk about the son's experience. So the father's up to work, and then the son's experience in the second stanza, and the sound of the poem is very different at that point.
Yeah, so the first line of the second stanza is, I'd wake and hear the cold splintering, breaking. Is that, I kind of still was hearing the house warming up there, that it was still, is there anything else there? I just heard like the creaking floorboards and maybe the, you know, as the thaw, as the old house started to thaw.
Yeah, I think that's a great way of putting it, because as we go on in that stanza, the iambic rhythm becomes a lot clearer. So when the rooms were warm, he'd call, and slowly I would rise and dress, fearing the chronic angers of that house. That's just a much more fluid kind of rhythm than what we had at the beginning, where it's, and put his clothes on in the blue-black cold, then with cracked hands. So I think I love the idea of the house kind of coming awake and moving from that, the noises that a house makes to a more fluid, and the family's going to wake up, and things will be a lot easier. I'm the only one who's confronting the house when it's in that icy grip is the father.
But there's also, even though the house is warming, this isn't a totally nostalgic look. It's not a complete, what's the word I'm looking for? Kind of like those Christmas mornings.
The sepia tinted, yeah.
Yeah, and life was grand. I mean, there's also fearing the chronic angers of that house.
Yeah,
which I mean, really jumps out in the middle of this. You feel like you're getting the father who's, you know, like we're in Seamus Heaney's territory where it's going to be very reverential toward the father. And then we get a line like that, that kind of is this cold reality of, you know, there was something to fear in there, and the angers were chronic.
Right. And obviously, Yeah, I mean, I think there's almost a hint of trauma there, and that's what makes the feelings in this poem so complicated, because the father is obviously strong and tough and and angry, inspiring fear in the child. You know?
Yeah, and we heard in the first stanza that no one ever thanked him, but there's one moment, even before we get to the two last lines, which are just incredible.
Perfect, yeah.
Even before we get there, there's one moment that really stood out to me where it says, he had driven out the cold and polished my good shoes as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that to me is the key detail of the whole poem and the whole understanding of the father. Because the son is looking back and he's saying, for all of these chronic angers, for all of the way that I spoke indifferently to him, you do get the feeling that the speaker probably had some real genuine grievances with his father. But what he's recognizing here is, even though he worked as hard as he did, which he may or may not have done for the kid might have just been a side benefit of that. And he warmed up the house, which he may or may not have done for the kid. You know, it might have been he was warming it up for himself. But the idea that he polished the speaker's kids, that he polished his shoes as well, it seems like the kind
just
of...
Just for the kid.
It would only be for the kid. He would only do it because of his love for his family and for his son. And that it was, the poet here is just recognizing, as hard as I was on him and as cold as things were between us, I have to remember that he was somebody who also would be up early, among other things, to polish my shoes.
Yeah. I mean, there's a real sense of guilt there and regret at not appreciating. I mean, although, like you say, the chronic angers line suggests that he may have had a good cause for being keeping a distance from his father.
Mm-hmm. And then the last two lines.
Right. So we've had this interesting dynamic of the this is a speaker who's looking back on childhood, and we've heard some stories from childhood. The father doing the work, and the child slowly getting up and speaking indifferently to his father. But now we're squarely in the present moment of the poem. So this is the speaker of the poem in the now. What did I know of love's austere and lonely offices? Mm. And it's the experience of the father that the speaker of the poem is relating to here now. In other words, the act of love is always an austere and lonely office, seemingly. And as a child, this kid didn't get any of that. But now that the speaker is older and presumably, you know, an adult man now, he's able to understand the austere and lonely offices that just come along with family life.
When you're a child, you want hugs and presents and, you know, ice cream.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're an adult, you appreciate the polished shoes.
Mm-hmm.
Ugh.
Interesting. And what about the repetition?
Of
what did I know?
Yeah. Well, you know, that's really earned, is how I looked at it, because the rest of the poem is so chiseled and so lapidary. And so the repetition really stands out. This is a poem that doesn't waste any words.
That's right. Yeah.
Then to have these words repeated, what did I know? What did I know? It really forces you to kind of give it an interpretation of the way that you would read that differently, or that it would be, I guess, just the repeated emphasis. It just haunted me.
Yeah. Yeah, it's this incantatory, like he's trying to resurrect the father, or trying to get back to the time when he could have appreciated the work that the father did.
Mm.
So do you think the poem is entirely, completely forgiving of the father for whatever these chronic angers might have been? And is this a kind of pure celebration of the father and the work that he did?
I don't think so. I think of it as the father was a bit limited.
Right.
But, and, you know, love has more than just austere and lonely offices. But there may be a type of person who gets painted into a corner, or, you know, for whatever reason, life gives them, puts some kind of spin on them that makes that the most that they're capable of.
Right.
And it's celebrating, you know, or it's respecting
that limited expression of love was at least
it was love. Yeah, it wasn't just, I mean, you could think, I would imagine that the kid probably thought, oh, he's polishing my shoes just because he's going to make me go to church. He's going to make me go to church, and it's discipline, and he's, you know, he's like a drill sergeant.
Right.
And it's basically, it's what he's saying here is, no, that was an expression of love. And so were the making the banked fires blaze and everything else he did, all the days of work he did. But he's also saying, let's not sugarcoat things here. He was also, you know, maybe not a very expressive person and maybe a person who it was difficult to find these acts of love in him.
Right.
And then but it was probably easy to see the chronic angers that made one afraid.
Interesting. Yeah. I love that last word, offices, too, because it has that connotation of religious ritual. And, you know, the poem said on Sunday morning, and he's going through the rituals, the offices. It's like an hourly job that he has to do. He is to polish the shoes and to build the fire and to do these things. So there's that connotation that this is the religious liturgy of a Sunday morning for this father.
Would you hand this poem to a father for Father's Day?
I guess it would really have to do.
I don't think I would.
I could imagine it if. Well, it would really depend on what the relationship with the between that particular father and son were. But
I mean, I think
obviously this poem is full of love for this father.
Yeah, but it's
moving for that reason.
But I mean, if you were the father and your kid handed you this, wouldn't you feel a little bit like, you know, like Michael Jackson's dad or something?
Well, and also just the, you know, like you say, it basically implies that the father's somewhat emotionally limited.
Yeah. Now, you didn't choose any poems from the father's perspective.
That's interesting because, I was thinking about the fact that I have two kids and.
Yeah. And you're a father and you read lots of poetry.
Right.
Has poetry helped you understand what it means to be a father?
That's a great question. I don't know. I don't know if we can keep this part of the interview. I don't have a good answer for it.
Well, here's what I think. And I kind of caught you off guard with the question, but yeah. I've been thinking about it. And I think it's really easy for a father to write bad poetry about being a father, like to write cliches, basically,
right.
Where it would be about the miracle of life or about feeling a sense of duty or wanting to do what's best for the kids. Or you write about how amazing the kids are and this sort of miracle of what they've done, or feeling your own mortality.
Right. Right.
You know, there's a lot of ways to be uninteresting.
Yeah.
Writing about fatherhood.
There are certainly exceptions to that none are springing to mind. To kind of bolster your point, Yeats has a poem called Prayer for My Daughter where it's really much more about him than about the daughter, and he expresses in this long poem, it's kind of an amazing poem, but it expresses wishes for his daughter which are really kind of at times cliche. He wants his daughter to be well-mannered and to find a good husband and to spread joy and not to be selfish and so on. So the very kind of like, you know, one question I'll often ask my students is if your father gave you this poem, how would you feel about it? It's a little bit simplistic in that regard, but when you read it as a projection of the way Yeats wished the world was at that particular moment in his life, it's a more interesting poem. But yeah, it's really hard, I think, to write about being a parent and not have it be a little bit cliche.
Here's what I would say, just to reclaim poetry, just to take poetry's side for a minute here. And this may sound a little grandiose, but it almost seems like all poetry, even poetry that's not about being a father, is helpful in the sense of anything that expands horizons and teaches empathy has made it easier to be patient, for example. And you know, a lot of the qualities that I aspire to as a father are things that poetry has often helped to, you know, show me how to see things from someone else's point of view, for example.
That's interesting. Yeah, so it helps you cultivate the skills that you need in order to be an effective father.
I think so. Plus, it's short enough that I don't have to, you know, War and Peace just takes a lot of time away from the kids. But
Right.
Poetry, you could just squeeze in a poem or two and
yeah,
still,
let's press pause on this argument. I'm going to read a few poems and then I'll come back.
Right. Okay. Well, I really enjoyed that, Professor Bill. Thanks for joining me again on the History of Literature, and I hope you have a nice Father's Day.
Yeah, you too, Jack. Thank you for having me.
Okay, wasn't that great? It's so much fun when Professor Bill is here. Now, I mentioned that I would pass along a piece about my own dad. I call it a piece. It's called The Flaming Arrow. I don't know what this is. A piece, a poem, I guess. I was trying to capture a moment, an understanding I had when my son and my dad bonded with each other, united by their laughter at me. And I was trying to capture my dad, the 50s guy, the decent, hardworking Wisconsin dude. Trying to capture the stories of his childhood that he'd handed down to me. Anyway, here it is, The Flaming Arrow. My father was an Eagle Scout, back when that meant something. Dropped in the woods, blindfolded, tied up, miles from anywhere. Survival skills you still needed back then. An initiation week, one day of hard labor, and no food, but all the water you could drink. A day of silence, no words could pass your lips, and a final night, camped on a riverbank, while across the waters, on an island, a Native American ceremony took place. A dance that ended with flaming arrows being fired into the water. The Eagle Scouts watching with flickering campfire shadows playing across their wide-eyed faces. It was only when my own son was 5 and I was pressing my dad for stories, the ones I used to listen to at night, in the car on our way home from the grandparents' house or from one of my dad's high school basketball games, that my dad chuckled and mentioned that those had not been real Indians on the island as far as he knew. I was astonished. I'd had no clue. The story had fit into my understanding of prairie and woods, Wisconsin, circa 1955. Then who were they? I demanded. Oh, probably some guy. Some guy? Sure, some guy in a suit. It mattered to no one but me. I, who had lost a memory that used to fill me with secret excitement and fear and safety, knowing that whatever the Wisconsin night could throw at us, my dad would not be afraid, having watched a hostile war party fire flaming arrows in his general direction. It made me question my other memories, the narratives that had shaped me. I'm pleased to report that most have held up. The 5-year-old who walked by himself to the diner, bought himself a piece of pie with ice cream for a dime that he'd stolen from his mother, confirmed. The college student who spent summers on a road crew, turning the trunk roads of Greene County from gravel to asphalt, verified. The honorable mention all-state basketball player who at 5'4" and with no jumping ability could never manage to touch the net unless it was a little unraveled, with a strand from a broken loop dangling down. That was a true story. And the 10-year-old who rode his bike around town, carrying a knife, hunting wild asparagus in the alleys and untended backyards and empty lots of Monticello, Wisconsin, racing to get there ahead of a neighbor, an adult who had 10 kids and was always on the lookout for the bounty of a little extra asparagus. That memory is unassailable. I live with what I have. holding on to all of it before I disappear. And these secondhand memories, the experience I had of listening to his stories, will die with me. And now, a new memory. Me being wrong. Trying to be a dad myself, learning something shocking, as my son and my dad share a laugh at how fooled I had been for so many years. I'll let them have it. My son will treasure it someday, and I, meanwhile, will keep the memories I have, and a new one that I won't share. The idea of the man, probably a drifter, one of the near hobos who hung around the barbershop in my dad's town, or one of those guys who stopped in at Barney's Ford Garage for the free coffee and the conversation. I can picture that guy every year putting on a costume, his annual ritual, painting some clumsy stripes on his face, performing a drunken dance, dipping an arrow in kerosene, setting it alight, and launching it across the water. The highlight of his year is the moment it hangs in the air, a wild streak of orange burning the night. Its landing point unknown. That's going to do it for this episode of The History of Literature. My thanks to Professor Hogan of Providence College for joining us and imparting his expertise. Best wishes to all you dads out there. Enjoy your day. And if you're going to see your dad, or maybe you miss your dad, my best wishes to you as well. I'm Jack Wilson. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time. Thank you.